in the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 11, and at the 20th verse. Hebrews 11 and 20, having finished with Abraham. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob, and Esau, in regard to their future, although their futures were very diverse, very different. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, nothing about him until then, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leant on the top of his staff. Worshipped the Lord, that means, of course. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, same again here, nothing about Joseph's exciting life. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites, the going out. That's what the word exodus means, exodus, the way out, about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt, and gave instructions about his bones, which are there still in Shechem. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict that all male Hebrews should be slain, because they were becoming too numerous, shades of Herod. By faith, Moses himself, the first faith is that of his parents, by faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose, but it was a strange way that it happened, by his killing the Egyptian, you remember, he chose to be ill-treated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin in the Egyptian court for a season, for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ. Notice Christ. Moses regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ. His faith must have reached right forward to Christ. It's wonderful, isn't it? He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward, that is, his heavenly reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn of Egypt would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. Amen. May God bless to us His holy word. The New Testament, Hebrews chapter 11, verses 20 to 29. After the mighty Abraham, a real anticlimax. You would think that the writer could hardly have said less about Isaac. But it is enough to preserve the line of faith, although Isaac is a remarkably passive conveyor of the blessing, don't you think? God wrought through Rebekah rather than through Isaac to accomplish his will. But all that was required here was that Isaac's faith should shine in regard to God's blessings on his two sons. Not that his blessing on Esau was what Esau wanted, but was more than he deserved, because God is gracious to sinners. It was the blessing of Jacob that counted, of course, and preserved the line. And so we come to Jacob. And it's almost shocking, isn't it, to find that our writer ignores practically the whole of Jacob's eventful life until he was dying. Why was this? Surely, because this is not history, but an account of the ongoing nature of faith. That it is forever, faith is forever pressing towards its goal. And as far as the Hebrews' particular goal is concerned, it has a long way to go, hasn't it? 2,000 years from Abraham to Christ. So it had better get going. And so it's the faith of these dying men looking to the next generations that is brought forward by the writer. Jacob's dying blessing is upon Joseph's two sons, his grandsons, for they became notable tribes in Israel's history, as we know, Ephraim and Manasseh. And at verse 22, our writer turns back a generation and picks up the fact that Joseph's faith was such as saw his people eventually return to the promised land and to the midst of it, as I said during the reading, to Shechem, where Joseph's bones still lie in his tomb, not with Abraham and Sarah and the others at Hebron in the mosque there. And so we come to Moses, whose parents, Amram and Jochebed, preserved him as a proper child, defying the Egyptian king's edict to slay all the Hebrew males. And so Moses spent the first 40 years of his life in the palace of Pharaoh's daughter, which doubtless put a stamp on him, wouldn't you think, that nothing would erase. 40 years in a royal palace, in the greatest nation of the earth of the day, Egypt. Modified, it would be, of course, his experience by other 2 40 years of radically different experiences in 2 different wildernesses, but Moses remained the prince he was nearly to the end. But his Hebrewness, you see, was even less erasable. He was a Hebrew after all, although he had lived as an Egyptian for 40 years. And at 40, his Hebrewness asserted itself in such a dramatic way that it determined, notice, the next 40 years of his life in the wilderness of Midian. Now, what man has ever had his long life divided so neatly into three sectors of 40 years? And with such diverse experiences in each of these three 40s. Moses went through practically every human experience you could think of. And if ever a man was trained by experience for leadership, he was the man. Naturally, the writer pauses here to expatiate on Moses' decision to associate himself with his people, which shows that faith is something that will assert itself even against the whole historic fabric of one of the most illustrious monarchies the world has ever seen, that of Egypt. You can't keep genuine faith down or out. And this is the essence of that faith, that it triumphs over all the worldly advantages which can be against it, and sees them and their bitter contempt of faith, the world's bitter contempt of faith, as itself so contemptible that the pleasures of the worldly world are regarded as less than nothing, less than the dust, compared with the onward march of God's people toward the promised land. And even the public disgrace in Egypt's favored dominion, the public disgrace of this adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter, must have been noised abroad throughout the country. And it must have been viewed with much distaste as the fugitive murderer, yes, murderer, the fugitive murderer fled from his youthful haunts in Egypt. But that didn't bother Moses, apparently. He was looking, as his line had been since Abram, he was looking a long way forward to Christ. So the Bible says, we read it this morning, looking a long way forward to Christ. And that was more to him when he came to himself, of course, than all the treasures of Egypt. He had the vision of the invisible, the city which had foundations, the heavenly Jerusalem, and its ruler and King Jesus Christ. So it says, and after 40 years in that healing and fortifying desert of Midian, nurtured by his gracious father-in-law Jethro, who, remember, was a Midian descendant of Abraham by Keturah, Abraham's other wife, Genesis 25 and 2. Oh, yes. Yes, Jethro was connected with Abraham. And so, in that desert where he had the healing and fortifying experience of living with this father-in-law, and at the behest of the God of the burning bush, after 40 years, Moses returned to Egypt to lead his people out. And that led, of course, to the Passover, with all its connotations of physical and spiritual deliverance from bondage to this worldly world of Egypt. Now, the Passover says so much as its connections with the Lord's Supper display. You see the connection between the two from our Lord's the Last Supper before he went to Gethsemane. And in the midst of all the action of Passover, we have the destruction of that godly Egyptian force. Their firstborn was slain because there was no blood on the lintels. Then their army was drowned in the Red Sea. And so we have the destruction of the army of Egypt, which would have enslaved the people of Israel perpetually. And we have salvation by the blood of sprinkling for the firstborn sons of Israel, delivering them from bondage in order that they might pass through the Red Sea on dry land, which the Egyptians in pursuit trying to do, following their example, were drowned. So, from the blood of sprinkling in the Passover to the blood of the Redeemer, Jesus Christ. The sprinkled blood saved the firstborn of Israel, as the lack of the sprinkling of blood on the lintel destroyed the firstborn of Egypt. For the blood, you see, is the great divider. The blood of the cross is the great divider. Salvation is only and altogether by the blood of Christ crucified. Otherwise, there is no hope for anyone, whoever they are, no hope for anyone otherwise than everlasting perdition. Now, that's as far as I want to go with the chapter today. There is too much in this passage thus far to skim over it as if it were a mere narrative. As I said before, it's not a history. It's not. It is more than a story. It is reality. It is the truth, albeit expressed in Old Testament terms, in terms of Old Testament typology. And it is the truth about the vicissitudes, the trials of faith, which is surely the most striking thing about the whole biblical record. The trials of faith, and about our present passage here. That's the most important thing. But let me ask you this question about faith. Why should faith, that infinitely precious gift of God, as Paul tells us, writing to the Ephesians, why should that infinitely precious gift of God, faith, be so hard to hold on to? And in God's own universe, not an alien universe, but his world, why should faith be so hard to hold on to? And why did it cost Moses, not to speak of others, so much? And the answer, of course, you know well, and hardly need to be told. But it's not so well known by all men, is it? Least of all the modern so-called well-educated. They are the most ignorant of all. I listened to a revived brains trust on television late one evening. And although there was a Christian philosopher on the panel, whom I had always assumed was evangelical, the answer of the four on the panel to the question, is there evil, was that there were evil people, but not abstract evil. Bad people, but there wasn't an abstract badness. But I wasn't looking for abstract evil, but for personal evil in a personal devil. It would seem that there is an unwritten law about so many programs of an intellectual order that the Bible must never be mentioned or its words quoted. Apparently, none of them believed in a personal devil. And the contempt with which the Bible was ignored surely showed to me the utter shallowness of these so-called brainy people. Give me a working-class person every day who left school at 14, or as I did at 13, for good, and ask him or her what they think. I couldn't get a worse answer from anyone than I got from these smart alecks. And they were so sure of themselves. What do these so-called clever people think they are? They don't even seem to know that the wisdom of the world is foolishness in the sight of God. But then back to our question, why is faith so hard to come by and costly to hold on to? And of course the answer is, whatever men say, that it is all because of the intrusion of evil and sin into the world. We know that fine, don't we? So let us apply that knowledge to faith in the life of Moses. It started, as we read, with his birth and his parents' intimation of faith that he was a proper child and should certainly not be sacrificed to the Egyptian decree that all male Hebrew children should be slain. Shades of Herod, as I was saying, to come. That led to the infant being brought up as a prince in the household of Pharaoh's daughter and a life of 40 years as a prince of Egypt. Can you think of anything as bizarre as that for a Hebrew child? Truth, far stranger than fiction. And then that incident of the Egyptian beating the Hebrew and Moses killing the Egyptian and hiding his body in the sand. But it was known. So that next day Moses, remonstrating with two Hebrews fighting together, one said to him, "Are you thinking of killing me as you did the Egyptian yesterday?" And Moses knew that the killing of the Egyptian was known, and it was the end of his days in Egypt. He had to flee the wrath of Pharaoh, who would have killed him for killing an Egyptian. Now, do you see what a mixture of faith and foolishness that sequence contains? Faith and folly. Faith, which was originally offered so freely and purely to Adam and Eve, was, by the fall, instantly compromised and opposed by man's own sin. And so we have the two, faith and sin, at war with each other throughout history and in a sequence Galatians 5:17. Flesh working against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh. Faith and sin. And we've to cope with both. You see, it's all very well to say that Hebrews chapter 11 is the great chapter on faith. But then, as we know from the Genesis record, Hebrews doesn't say everything about these Old Testament characters by a long way. We know that muted as the saints' follies are in the Hebrew record, the facts of their follies cannot be disputed nor forgotten. You see, as if it were not enough that by the fall evil gained entrance to the human scene, fallen man himself, from Adam and Eve onwards, by their own follies, have deliberately added to the disaster areas, by such as, for example, Moses killing the Egyptian. What had that to do with faith? Absolutely nothing. Sin. Sin. And Moses a murderer. But then, by that very folly and flight, Moses was prepared during the next 40 years in the wilderness of Midian for his great leadership of Israel, to lead Israel out of Egypt and nearly into Canaan. There are no mistakes with God, for he is able to absorb all our follies into his sovereign purposes so that they actually contribute to the consummated whole of holy history. Why, the death of Jesus alone proclaims the power of God to turn what would appear to be the Almighty's greatest disaster, the death of his Son, into his greatest triumph. Now, I wish we could see that more clearly and more often than we do. How we are cowed before Satan's onslaughts. And immediately we begin to wail, don't we, when we're in trouble, whereas our worst seeming defeats should have us rising with renewed and strengthened faith to say, no, we will not be browbeaten by the devil. Let God turn the stratagems of the enemy into new fields of endeavor, as in Moses' case here, for the faith. And then, 40 years later, a long, long time, 40 years later, on Moses' return to Egypt, he led the people of Israel out of bondage. Which leads the writer to the Passover and what it has to teach us. Let's look at that. It marks the birth of the nation of Israel. Moses, out of a mass of Hebrew slaves, fashioned a nation and gave them faith. For after 10 dreadful plagues, Pharaoh relented and let the people go. Ah, but there was no time to waste on leavening the bread. If they were to eat before they left, it would have to be roast lamb with mat sauce, unleavened bread, M-A-T-Z-O-S. But it was the blood of the lamb which saved their firstborn, and the lack of the blood over the lintel which destroyed the firstborn of Egypt, and thus condemned Egypt for their wickedness to Israel. And it is, you see, in the teeth of all this satanic opposition to the survival and the welfare of God's chosen race. In the teeth of all that opposition, that a way was provided by the inspiration of God descending on Moses. A way was provided to lead his people out of bondage into the prospects of the promised land. A land with its milk and honey, symbolic of the heavenly land which Abraham and his descendants were moving towards. And all this, you see, prefigures the cross of Christ. Although there were something like 1,500 years between the two events, the Passover and the cross, 1,500 years encompassing during Israel's long history innumerable oppositions to faith in the life of the tortured people and the sinful people of Israel. Yet all these oppositions were overcome and faith triumphed until there emerged in the fullness of time the fulfillment of the great promise to Abraham so long ago. And Christ appeared to face, he appeared to face the greatest opposition to faith ever endured, ever engineered by God's enemy. And gloriously defeated in the victory of the cross. And its outcome, the resurrection. What a record to span all these years. Does it not put the struggles of our own faith into context? As with the years, I have become accustomed, along with many of you, to battle on gloriously with more than sufficient physical strength to cope with all the spiritual problems of the Lord's work. And I suppose it never occurred to me in earlier life that if I was spared to work into my 80s, there would be times of physical infirmity which, without the inspiration of the continuing ministry to spur one on, would have necessitated laying down the burden and letting another take it up. And I can tell you quite frankly that many times in the course of a day, when the simple act of getting up off a chair can be a major consideration, I say to myself, I can't go on like this much longer. And then I think that there has been no impairment of my mind during 50 years, but rather a sharpening of it, if anything. And I say to myself, don't you often? Come on, man. Let's go on fighting the good fight of faith and not give up until the Lord in his wisdom and grace allows an honorable release. And that's the position. So that poor things though we undoubtedly are compared with mighty Abraham and Moses, we march on in their tradition, same faith, like Ignatius Loyola, whose prayer, you remember, was, teach us, good Lord, to serve thee as thou deservest, to give and not to count the cost. That's not easy. To fight and not to heed the wounds, to toil and not to ask for any reward, save that of knowing that we do thy will. That's it, isn't it? Fight on in his strength, with his gift. I was thinking in prayer, was I not, about the gift of faith seeming so dim before a worldly world that has no sight of it at all. And yet, if it's God's gift, if it's his gift he has planted in our breasts, it will survive, it will grow, and we will triumph if we go on to the end, even if the end seems sometimes bitter. But the end itself will never be bitter. It will be glorious. Now, I thought we should end our service this morning with the hymn, Fight the Good Fight. But as I read it, I thought it was a little bit too interned. So I looked at the hymn next to it, 518, and I thought that was worthier our aim and intention. A charge to keep I have. I've sung this since I was less than a teenager. A charge to keep I have, a God to glorify, ending with the lines, and let me not my trust betray, but press to realms on high. 518.